Support for WKAR is provided by Fluke Hearing, featuring American-made products that provide hearing technology for every lifestyle and life stage, with 8 locations throughout mid-Michigan. FlukeHearing.com. And by the MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, alumni enrichment, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu.
It's 9 o'clock, and I'm Mark Bayshore. Welcome to Current State. We're glad you're back. Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero, on the record as of yesterday, according to MLive, supporting a Lansing ballot initiative that would alter the city charter and legalize the possession of an ounce of marijuana by adults 21 and older on private property. That ballot initiative reportedly has the necessary signatures to go before voters. And one other news tidbit here to start the program with, WKAR-TV's off-the-record host Tim Skubick reports today that Michigan Congressman Dave Camp has said he has discussed running for the U.S. Senate from Michigan for the GOP next year. That report also from MLive. Tim writes that Camp would have to be considered the front runner should he commit, creating a face-off between the establishment wing of the Republican Party, that's Congressman Camp's, and the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, many of whom are supporting announced candidate Terry Lynn Land. We've got a good show for you here today. We hope you stick around. It is August here in Michigan and harvest time for the state's signature crop, sweet and tart cherries, is over. The fruit belt that hugs the Lake Michigan shoreline depends heavily on thousands of migrant workers who come each season to work on the farms. Growers fared much better this year than in 2012 when a killing frost destroyed much of the crop and deterred the labor force. But a new report out today shows that overall Michigan's migrant and seasonal farm worker population is growing. Here to talk about that with us is Dr. Alice Larson, the study's author. Hi, Alice.
Hi.
And Molly Shire, the director of the Office of Migrant Affairs for the Michigan Department of Human Services. Welcome, Molly.
Good morning.
Alice Larson, what's the purpose of this report? Why did you do this?
Well, this report, funded by Michigan, is looking at the number of migrant and seasonal farm workers and also those in the family who would not be doing farm work, so both those kinds of estimates, in every county in Michigan.
Okay. It's a head count, basically.
It is a head count, although I didn't have the luxury of going out and actually interviewing farm workers. So this study is really based on existing information, and it's very, very interactive. So I spent a lot of time talking to those in Michigan who are experts in agriculture or working with farm workers. I had the pleasure of doing a site visit for 2 weeks in the fall, running around various places, talking to people who actually produce crops and, again, work with the population. And I've been working with the Michigan Interagency Migrant Services Committee very closely in gathering as much information as already exists in the state from a variety of sources about migrant and seasonal farm workers. And that's how the report was prepared.
So of Michigan's 83 counties, how many have migrant farm workers?
Oh, man, you have to ask me that question. Actually, I think there were only two counties where we determined that there weren't any farm workers
wow.
at all. Very
okay.
few. So some counties have very little, and then some counties have quite a bit.
But as we suggested in the setup here, is the population really focused along the West Coast? Of Michigan, the fruit crop workers?
It definitely is. Western Michigan is where the predominant number of migrant and seasonal farm workers are, for sure.
Okay. Molly, let's bring you into this. Tell us about your work with the state of Michigan. How are you involved with the migrant farm worker population exactly?
I'm the director of the Office of Migrant Affairs at DHS, and that means I oversee our migrant program. We have about 45 migrant program specialists who provides services to farm workers in over 20 counties. So I develop training and the tools and resources that those DHS employees need to reach this population and be able to serve them effectively.
Okay. And tell us more about your report here, Alice. I know the last time you did a really comprehensive kind of headcount was 2006. What have you found here more recently?
Well, more recently, we found a slight increase in the number of migrant and seasonal farm workers. And I actually should probably define who we're talking about here when I say migrant and seasonal
farm
workers. So for Michigan, agriculture is really dependent a lot on people coming to the state to harvest primarily those crops that require a lot of labor all at the same time. For instance, apples, blueberries, asparagus, cherries. And so those people who come from out of state, travel to Michigan, and then leave after the work is finished, we call them migrant workers. And this can also include people who, for instance, live in eastern Michigan, the Thumb area, and then travel to western Michigan to work in the fruit harvest.
Well, it's but not aren't just people able, from Mexico, necessarily, or
right, so
south
it can include
border.
Migrants can include sort of both things. And the secret, the real key to the definition is you can't return to your normal home at night. And seasonal farm workers are actually people who live locally and do the same kind of work, but they're doing it locally. And so they return to where they normally live at night. So when I say migrant and seasonal farm workers, those are the people that I'm talking about.
Molly, what challenges are involved in having this migrant workforce in terms of having a stable, reliable presence here from year to year?
It is a challenge, and obviously this is a population that's very mobile, that moves around frequently. It's a population that doesn't speak English. We do have many English-speaking farm workers here in Michigan, but many are Spanish-speaking. And it certainly is a population that we want to know as much about as possible, both from the standpoint of providing services and from the standpoint of our labor needs for our agriculture industry, since our agriculture industry is so important. It's our second largest industry in the state.
What special provisions do we make as a state, Molly, for migrant families? Health care if they're uninsured, education, housing? Get into that a little bit for us.
We do have a great network of services. I chair our Interagency Migrant Services Committee, which is comprised of 26 state and federal agencies and nonprofits that serve farm workers as well as grower interests. And that's a really important committee that coordinates service delivery to migrant and seasonal farm workers. So involved are health organizations that have migrant health clinics. DHS, of course, provides services in the form of benefits for those who are eligible. We have state MIOSHA and our Department of Agriculture housing licensing folks who are involved and make sure that our housing is licensed and up to code. Those are just a few of the ways that we take care of this population.
And this is all part of the Michigan budget from year to year.
Well, it is and it isn't. Many of the organizations are also nonprofits who are getting their funding from a variety of sources. As far as the state agencies are concerned, yes.
Okay, but what segment of the public budget of the Michigan state budget is assigned to this? Do you know?
I don't have those figures.
Okay. Now, one of the big challenges I'm led to believe is hiring workers legally. Technically, the only way that I'm aware of to legally hire migrants is through the H-2A program, but it's not used very often in Michigan, from what I understand.
No, the H-2A program is not used often, but we do have many migrant farm workers who can register with our Workforce Development Agency who are from Texas, Florida, or here seasonally, and that is definitely a large source of our workforce.
We're talking with Dr. Alice Larson, who's the author of a study on Michigan's migrant farm population, also with Molly Shire, the director of the Office of Migrant Affairs for the Michigan Department of Human Services. Dr. Larson's study is released here today. Take us a little bit more to the actual farms where these people work. You had occasion to visit at least one of these, I think you said.
Well, what I did is I talked to a lot of extension agents and also agricultural producers and those involved with crop and farmer associations, because my estimates are based on what's going on in agriculture. So if crops are being changed, if more blueberries are being grown, for instance, which is one thing that appears to be the case in Michigan, then more workers are required in order to help with those harvests.
How do you interpret this bump from 06 to 2013?
Well, it's really interesting. It's a whole variety of things because one thing that's true in agriculture is it changes all the time. And so it's sort of jumping in at this point and saying, so what's going on today? And from what I heard, there's been an increase in blueberry acreage, not all of which is hand harvested, but a good proportion is. Also, your nursery and food processing industries, which are also related industries that I looked at, have also increased.
Molly, you've got something to add to that?
Yes, and overall, our agriculture and food sector grew from the time the 2006 study was conducted until now. So it's really no surprise that we have higher numbers of migrant and seasonal farm workers, because during a time when Michigan was in a deep recession, this sector of the economy was actually growing. It was expanding.
What about how would a new federal immigration bill impact this situation? Any thoughts on that, Molly?
It would definitely contribute to the stability of the workforce, which would be a good thing for the industry and for workers.
Alice, any comment on that? It's a pretty hot topic in Washington.
Right, and I agree 100%. I mean, it's certainly, you know, concern over immigration affects what growers do with their crops. It affects what workers do in terms of deciding to come and stay in agriculture and assist. So some stability in that would certainly help production in Michigan and states all over the country.
That's Dr. Alice Larson, who's the author of a new study on Michigan's migrant farm worker population. She was joined by Molly Shire, the director of the Office of Migrant Affairs for the Michigan Department of Human Services. Thanks for joining us on Current State.
Thank you for having us.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. This spring, the Michigan Senate passed Bill 78, which prohibits state agencies from setting aside land to maintain biodiversity. The bill has drawn strong criticism from various environmental groups who argue the bill would be a setback for land conservation and harmful to Michigan's ecosystems. Dr. Brad Cardinale is a professor at the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources. Cardinale and 133 other scientists from around the state have penned a letter to Governor Rick Snyder against the bill, requesting that he veto the legislation if it passes the House. And we welcome Dr. Brad Cardinale to Current State. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for joining us. Let's start by breaking down Senate Bill 78. Explain, in your view, what this bill would do.
Well, there's two things that this bill would do. The first, as you said in your introduction, it would prevent any state agency from managing or setting aside public lands for the explicit purpose of maintaining Michigan's flora and fauna. It also redefines the term conservation to focus much more on extraction of natural resources through fracking, through lumbering, and through mining. And then the last thing, and also very concerning, is it would prevent state agencies from managing any ecosystem so that it could be restored and managed sustainably into the future.
Well, now, for those who support Senate Bill 78, what is the goal here? Is this an attempt to juice up the state's economy then with more mining, timber, et cetera?
Yeah, you have to, I think, set this bill in the political and economic backdrop of the state right now. We are coming out of a recession, and many of our leaders who are in the House and the Senate believe that one thing that could give us an economic stimulus is to use our state lands, our public lands, for more natural extraction of resources through lumbering, fracking, and mining. And so there's been a sequence of environmental laws that have either been repealed, changed, or enacted that would make it open up our opportunities for us to do that. Senate Bill 78, I think, is just one in a sequence of bills. This one is being sponsored by Senator Tom Casperson. And Casperson has long had some concerns about Michigan Department of Natural Resources, who he believes really limits our ability to use public lands for purposes of extraction. And he is in particular concerned about what's called the Living Legacies Program. The Living Legacies Program would set up a sequence of what are called biological stewardship areas throughout the state. These are some public lands, but they would also be conserved with private lands through voluntary programs, where we would try to conserve the majority of Michigan's flora and fauna in a relatively small area of the state. But Senator Casperson believes that would limit our ability to use those small amounts of state lands for other purposes. And so he basically drafted Senate Bill 78 to prevent this Living Legacies program from moving forward. The problem is that his bill does not ever mention the Living Legacies program, and it doesn't ever mention any of these biological stewardship areas. And instead, it just makes very broad sweeping generalizations that we shouldn't be able to manage for biodiversity in the state.
Do we have areas right now in Michigan that, that are similar to the BSAs that are basically set aside and protected from this kind of development?
We do have areas in the state, public lands, that are managed for balancing recreation, balancing the conservation of biodiversity, balancing, you know, things like extraction of lumber, trees. We do not currently have a systematic means of conserving biodiversity in the state by setting up a reserve of hotspots of biodiversity that would guarantee that our flora and fauna are conserved into the future. And so that's what the biological stewardships area was supposed to do, is come up with a coordinated plan for the state for conservation. And incidentally, a plan like that is something that is actually required for state forestry certifications. We have two certifications that give the state credibility as a sustainable forestry industry. And all of these certifications require that you have a management plan for the state's biodiversity.
Now, I'm led to believe some of the reading that I've done on this suggests that biodiversity plays a significant role in terms of invasive species. Can you explain how that works?
Yeah, so there's really abundant scientific evidence that a great variety of ecosystems, whether they're forests, lakes, grasslands, you name it, are much better able to resist invasive species if they have a diverse set of native species. And generally, the idea is that if you have a wide variety, a diverse native flora or fauna, those native flora and fauna are very good at taking up all of the biologically essential resources, the, you know, the light, the nutrients, the water, the things that limit the growth of plants and animals. And by being very efficient at taking all of that up, it makes it very difficult for an invasive species to come in and get itself established in the diverse system. So managing for biodiversity is one of the primary ways that we try to prevent invasive species, or we prevent pests and disease that might damage our forests.
In a way, you have natural predators. That's a kind of a clumsy way to refer to it, but you've got things built into the ecosystem that would resist an invasive species. Is that it?
That's it.
Okay.
And a lot of my work personally has actually been in the field of biological control in agricultural systems that produce our food. I've done work in soybeans and alfalfa and other types of crops where we see that if there are a wide variety of what we call natural enemies, but those are essentially, you know, viruses, bacteria, insects that might eat pests like aphids, Systems that have a diverse group of these natural enemies are much better able to control our pests and disease, and the end result is that we get higher crop yields.
Does anyone in Senator Casperson's camp argue that the state has been overly cautious with regard to the environment? Is that a part of their message here?
I think that is a part of their message. I think that there is a sense among certain legislatures right now that we've got a lot of public land that could be used to sort of help us get out of the economic downturn. And that perhaps by setting aside too much of that land, we're preventing ourselves from digging out of the hole.
Can a case be made for that, in your view?
I think very legitimately a case can be made like that. But I think that, you know, nobody is arguing that we shouldn't be able to use these public lands for economic growth or extraction. And in fact, even the biological stewardship areas that the DNR has proposed, they would not change our ability to log forest. They wouldn't necessarily change mining rights. There are certain things that would be incompatible with biodiversity conservation. You can't clear cut a forest in its entirety and still conserve biodiversity. But I think what a lot of people don't recognize is that if done correctly, certain kinds of lumbering can actually be very beneficial to biodiversity. And so I think that the folks in Senator Casperson's camp are viewed perhaps as going a little bit too far, where they perhaps want to extract too much.
Okay.
And that would perhaps influence our ability to manage our ecosystems sustainably into the future.
You were one of 133 scientists who signed this letter. What does that say? What's significant about the fact that all you scientists have come together to offer your opinions on a political matter?
Well, I think there's two things that are significant about it. I mean, one is that these 133 scientists are all professors who practice and do research at the 14 Michigan institutions. All of us trained students who are going to go on and be the foresters in the state, who are going to manage our water quality in the state. Collectively, we've got tens of thousands of years of experience and thousands of peer-reviewed publications. So these are sort of the who's who of academic scientists that deal with natural resources in the state. And they're coming together and they're saying, this bill is a really bad idea. It is going to hurt our ability to maintain healthy and productive ecosystems in the state that many of which are sort of the foundation for our prosperity in the long term. And we're very concerned that if this bill is enacted and we don't protect biodiversity, that we're going to hinder our ability to be prosperous into the future. I think The second thing that I think is really significant about it is that typically academic scientists don't chime into the political arena because they're very concerned that doing so might compromise their view of objectivity. But this particular bill was so scientifically illiterate that I think that many academic scientists just said we can't stand in the background and not say something.
Hmm. The letter's not been sent yet. Is it your group's plan to send it?
Yeah. If as we anticipate, the bill passes through the House after the summer recess, then our plan would be to pass this on to Governor Schneider and ask him to veto the bill. And if he does, in fact, go ahead and pass Senate Bill 78, it's going to be against the best advice of his scientists in the state.
Okay, you do anticipate the measure to be passed by the House then?
Everything that we've heard so far is that, yes, the bill will be deliberated, but there is supposedly enough votes that it should pass the House and pass it readily. Just as it did the Senate not too long ago, where it passed essentially along party lines.
Well, Dr. Brad Cardinale is a professor at the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources. Dr. Cardinale, thanks for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. More Current State coming up after NPR News. Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Welcome back. In a recent op-ed piece in the Lansing State Journal, our next guest sounded an alarm over federal cuts to workforce training. As CEO of Capital Area Michigan Works, Doug Stites wrote of a 20% funding cut this year to his agency and of $1 billion in total cuts nationally to such efforts. Stites maintains the cuts come at a time when efforts to retrain Michigan workers for in-demand jobs are critically important. At the same time, some number of taxpayers appear skeptical of the publicly funded agency's work. Here to talk about all of that, Capital Area Michigan Works CEO Doug Stites. Welcome to Current State, Doug.
Thanks.
I think people associate Michigan Works with the state because of the name of the agency, Michigan Works, but most of your funding is from the U.S. government?
Virtually 100%.
Virtually 100%. What is your total budget, and how much from the feds? How much is that?
Our total budget this year is about $12-13 million. At its high point, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, we were at about $25 million.
So just about in half from half of your budget has been cut.
Right.
And that is a half a dozen years old.
Right.
What's been the impact of that? How have you adjusted to that?
Well, we've cut staff. We're going through a process tomorrow where we're going to streamline and reduce overhead by eliminating contractors and go to a single contractor system. I won't go into much detail, but we're trying to flatten out to get more of the money we've got into services and less into overhead. So, but the fact is, we still get about the same number of people coming in our door every day, and the people that are still left over from the recession who don't have the skills to compete in today's economy, because we are generating some number of jobs in the Lansing region. We're not where we'd like to be, but we are making progress. The employers who have openings, those jobs require skills, and the people that are left don't have the skills for those openings. So it's a matter of retraining those people, and we don't have the resources to retrain as many people as we'd like to.
That's the heart of your mission, is retraining.
Yes.
Reskills. We've been hearing about the skills mismatch issue here in Michigan for a few years now. Can you give us a common mismatch scenario? Somebody comes to your agency looking for work, and they simply don't have the other way of phrasing that is, what are the in-demand jobs right now in this area?
Well, the in-demand jobs, we'll talk about sectors rather than jobs, but they're in information technology, healthcare, and advanced manufacturing. Those
sure.
would be three sectors. Another one you could add in is business and business services, insurance, and finance. The people that are coming to us were dislocated during the recession primarily in manufacturing. So the state in total lost about 500,000 jobs in manufacturing, and we have not recovered those jobs. So those people, many of them don't have the skill sets to compete for the jobs that we are now creating. And it's unlikely, though we've had a small resurgence in manufacturing since the auto sector started adding some back in. Our area and our region, we're up to about 18,000 jobs in manufacturing. Very unlikely we'll build back up to what we had pre-recession, or even in the years even well before the recession. So it's been good for the jobs we've got back manufacturing, welcome them, but we'll never add back to the multitude we had before. The jobs we're adding in, as you know, headlines recently, Jackson National Life's going to add 1,000 jobs in. The
exactly.
people that are going to get those are very unlikely to be the people that were dislocated during the recession. They don't have the right skills to compete for that kind of employment.
We're still making this transition from a manufacturing environment that really just essentially required a high school education. We're still fighting that battle.
Well,
is that what
say,
you're saying?
Well, a bit, but even I want to be careful. Manufacturing's transforming itself where they want people with more education than a high school itself. So
gotcha.
I want to be careful as we characterize manufacturing. They want people with post-high school training and advanced skills. But the rest of the economy is asking for people with much more skills, and so you refer to it as the knowledge economy.
Sure.
And our region even struggles there. We're below the national average for people with advanced degrees in our region. Our state's well below the national average. We're only at 25%. So we're not a well-educated state, and our region's not well-educated. So, you know, we write frequently about the Keep Learning, an initiative we've done with the local educators and the media to talk about the fact. Ultimately, If we're going to compete for high-wage jobs based on the knowledge economy, we're going to have to raise our profile, which is a larger issue than just reskilling current workers. It's about if we want to look like Madison, Wisconsin, which is approaching 40% of the workforce with a four-year degree, and we're at 27%, we're going to have to, over the long haul, truly understand to compete for the kind of jobs that are in a knowledge economy. We're going to have to work on that for a long period of time, and we're well positioned. We do have the institutions to do it. It's a question of, do we have the will?
Well, here in the capital area, we fare better than the state as a whole, too, on four-year degrees. Do we not?
Just barely. Just 2 percentage points, but we're below the national average for four-year degrees.
Okay.
So Michigan's well below it. Lansing is below it. Ann Arbor is well ahead of it, so we would like to look more like Ann Arbor than we do currently. And as again, it's not a lack of having the institutions to do it, which is one of our great assets. If we could just build a four-year institution, if we could just build a community college, which a lot of areas of the state, that's their problem, is they'd like to look like us in terms of capacity and infrastructure. We have the infrastructure to do it. So it's not a matter of, well, if we just had the institutions to raise our profile of education. We're blessed with that in this region.
So the institutions need to be graduating more people.
Well, they graduate, and we've got to learn how to figure out how to keep them.
Okay.
It's not a matter of graduating, and we do. The answer is, how do we keep them, and how do we grow companies at the same time?
Last fall, I reported on the ePathways training program involving LCC and Capital Area Michigan Works. This is an effort to fill, sometimes, from what I reported, hundreds of available IT positions here in the area. How is ePathways doing?
We're going to enroll about 200 people in total in associate's degrees, 100 new ones this fall at LCC.
Sounds like it's doing great.
Well, we've got to get them through and get them graduated in the workplace. So we're not at that point, but we're at the front end of getting them into school. And then, of course, we'd like to see a lot of them, once they complete their associate degrees, get into companies, keep on going, and turn those associate degrees eventually into baccalaureate degrees at places like Michigan State.
Sounds like the ePathways program is really the sweet spot, because IT openings were, I think, the first thing you mentioned in terms of in-demand occupations.
Right. Well, IT is ubiquitous. It's almost in every place we go. Healthcare, information technology, manufacturing. Everybody relies on IT now. So it's in the backroom operation of almost every endeavor we have in the Lansing region. Summit's a standalone, places like Liquid Web. Almost 400 jobs, purely IT, but it's also in healthcare, electronic medical records. It's one of the fastest growing occupations in places like Sparrow and McLaren. IT is everywhere now, and the more IT workers we have in this region, the better all the companies do, and they're all looking for IT workers.
Are the most recent cuts you're facing a result of the federal sequestration?
That's a compound effect, but we were cut the year before 20%. So one good thing that's happened is the Senate last week, for the first time in 10 years, has passed out of a subcommittee the reauthorization of our program. House has passed it. Now the Senate's passed it. We have to get it to the Senate floor, which would maybe reauthorize WEA, which is an old law. It's back in the 1990s, and if we could get it reauthorized, maybe that would spur Congress and the administration to say, well, let's refurbish this law, which is antiquated. And if it was refurbished, perhaps then they would reauthorize new funding for a new law that would really bring us up to date in this century, because this law is from the last century, and maybe that would give us new funding.
Well, go a little deeper with us. How is it antiquated?
Well, it was passed in 1998. You can imagine the times in the workforce were far different in 1998. Mm-hmm. We've gone through a multitude of changes, and the restrictions in what we can do in terms of helping workers and companies, in terms of training workers. This was designed in 1995, passed in 1998. It really doesn't look like what the workforce and the economy look like in 2013. So a new law with new changes, new flexibility to deal with the labor force and demands would really be helpful. And if that's passed, perhaps that would spur Congress to authorize new funding.
Okay, additional funding.
Even if they just would restore some of the funding. The restoration of funding would be important.
Do you notice an improvement in keeping college graduates in the Lansing area? Is that ticking up even modestly?
In the tenths of percents, just very, very slow. not if it was a thermometer out there and we were watching it, you'd have to get very close to see it moving.
What's the missing piece there?
Well, it's a young adults, which is the key group for moving that percentage. There, it's a combination of place, not just employment. It's place, and they're looking for urban core centers. So it's revitalizing our urban core center. They don't want to live where I live. As you know, I'm an old graybeard. So exactly what I want, they don't want. They want a vibrant downtown. They want dense living. They want walkable communities. Many of them don't even want to own a car. So that's heresy to those of us that grew up in the 60s.
Right.
And so the very things we've got to ask, what do they want? Where do they want to live? If we're going to attract young talent to our region, which is and keep them. So when you spoke earlier about graduates, those young graduates are frequently flocking to urban core centers. Urban core centers, though, that have a major research university of the size of Lansing have an ability to be major players in the new economy. If you don't have this university, you really can't play if you're a city and region of 500,000 like us. But with this university, places the size of Madison and Lansing can become major economies because you do have that university.
Federal money is being cut, but 2 years ago, in a state auditor general report, the agency was taken to task for a membership at the Country Club of Lansing and for, I believe it was an $18,000 weekend retreat. Are you confident in your current spending priorities at Capital Area Michigan Works?
Well, that wasn't our retreat. That was a different Michigan Works agency, so I won't,
okay.
I won't speak to that. But
okay.
we had a membership where we just used the Lansing Country Club for our meetings, so it wasn't social. It wasn't anything. I'd never been there. I don't golf. I'm not a golfer. But the agency just used the Lansing Country Club as a place to hold board meetings and large gatherings. And we agreed with the state just to forego it. It was a legal expense. It had been looked at and audited many times. So we disagree with the auditor entirely. It's totally legitimate. Had been there for 25, 28 years. But just to avoid any further discussion about it, we just dropped it. It was a legal expense. There was not, the auditor was wrong. But we just foregone it. The other expenses that were listed in there were not ours.
Okay.
In the audit report, because that was all Michigan Works agencies around the state. It was not Capital Area.
But you're confident in your current spending priorities at the agency?
Well, we've cut out 21% of our administrative costs this year coming up, trying to push more money to the front end. So I don't think we're ever comfortable that we're doing enough. We always have to get leaner. And as I said, tomorrow we're going to get even leaner yet by trying to eliminate layers of administration at our contractor level. But at some point, you still don't have enough money to serve all the people that come in. And so at the end of the day, I don't think anything we're going to do is going to be able to allow us to serve all the customers for the needs that they come in. So I'm still concerned that with a 20% cut this year, 20% cut last year, we still have about 1,000 people walk through the door every day.
Mm.
And at some point, you don't give them the services they need to attach themselves. My goal is to turn them into taxpayers. And so they become citizens that are paying taxes. That's what they'd like to do. And that's what I'd like to help them become.
Okay.
And that's the thing we're not doing for enough of them right now.
Okay. Doug Stites is CEO of Capital Area Michigan Works. Thanks, Doug.
You bet.
Good luck. Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Texas-based Whole Foods announced plans last week to open a new store on Grand River Avenue in Meridian Township in 2015. It'll be very close to several other stores with similar products. Foods for Living and the East Lansing Food Co-op. We're joined now by the general manager of Elfco, Dave Finette, for some reaction to the announcement. Hi, Dave.
Good morning.
How long have you been in the food co-op business then?
I joined my first co-op in 1985, so quite a while.
Okay. But Elfco goes way back.
Elfco, right? Yeah, started in the 70s and incorporated in 76, and been our current location since around 1980.
There must have been a number of co-ops who have experienced the same kind of thing with a large store moving in close by. Have you looked at that? How has this played out in other places?
Sure. Yeah, we certainly have. We've got a lot of support from other co-ops around the country and people to draw on for how to address this issue. And
yeah,
they typically see, you know, a fairly sizable sales drop when Whole Foods or Trader Joe's opens up, 10-30% for between 6 months and a year. But then most of them find that their sales, you know, come back up to, you know, prior levels pretty quickly.
How big a concern is this projected opening of Whole Foods for you?
I don't know yet. I mean, we haven't really, you know, gotten a chance to sit down with, you know, with the board and then the board with Elfco's owners and talk about it. So it's certainly a concern, and I'm looking at already trying to get some help from other co-ops to see what they can give us as far as hints on how to deal with it. But we'll see. I guess I am confident that our owners will step up. You know, in 2005, 2006, Elfco was close to closing. We were having real financial issues. And at that point, the owners really stepped up and saved the co-op. And so I think that they've got it in them to do that again, to really support it through this.
As the general manager, can you anticipate the kinds of adjustments you might make in operating the food co-op? Should the Whole Foods really make an impact here? Operationally, yeah. What does that mean?
Well, I think for us, you know, one of the things is right now my inclination is to think that we'll stay the course. I think what we do is very different than what Whole Foods does. We're incredibly dedicated to local our local economy, working with local producers, providing our shoppers, you know, very environmentally friendly local product that chains really have a hard time because of their supply chain. They really have a hard time doing that. So I think that's really our edge, and I don't see a reason yet why we would change that.
You satisfy locavores. That would be your argument. People who want their food grown locally.
Yeah, I mean that, and I think people who are looking for really good food. You know, one of the things that we found in co-ops is that folks come to co-ops because they trust us. They know that we're not there to make a buck, but that we're there to provide the service to our owners and to our community. So I think that's one of the big differences that we focus on.
Just as a point of information, we'll point out that Mark Kieselbach, who is the Director of Community Planning and Development for Meridian Township, responded to a call from WKAR and said that Whole Foods did not receive any tax incentives to locate in Meridian Township. He also said that it's possible that the first work may begin yet this year, and the project could be done by the fall of 2014, which is a little bit earlier in estimate than previously reported. What do you think is the difference between a co-op customer and a Whole Foods customer? Is there much overlap there?
I think there's some similarities, certainly. I think that, you know, I have to admit, I don't know that many Whole Foods shoppers. I may not be able to speak to this very well, but yeah, I think Whole Foods is more of a it's a different lifestyle choice, I think, than co-op shoppers. I think there's a different value set there, probably.
Okay.
I tend to think that co-op shoppers and owners are more community minded, and understand the bigger picture. Whereas I think what I hear from Whole Foods shoppers, you know, and people that I know who do shop, who go to Ann Arbor and shop at that one, say, is that they're looking for things that satisfy them and their needs and their desires, mm-hmm. and are not as concerned with the, you know, externalities of that purchase.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a retail vibe to Whole Foods that I think you sidestep at a food co-op.
Well, I think, you know, Whole Foods certainly, they run very nice stores, and they, you know, they're it certainly is an experience to go there.
Oh yeah, no doubt.
And you know. But I think co-ops have come a long way from their sort of bulk bin granola and tofu, you know, bulk tofu days in the 60s and 70s.
Okay.
So we're running really nice stores as well.
For folks who have been in this town for 20-plus years, this seems kind of like deja vu, because when Foods for Living went in just a little way from Elfco, there were some questions about what effect it would have, and yet you guys have survived. Will adding Whole Foods get you closer to a tipping point? That must be a concern. with Foods for Living already there?
Sure. I think, again, that remains to be seen what the effects are going to be. We're going to do our best to guess, and based on information we get from other co-ops, and adjust accordingly. You know, I will say I do think that there's a likelihood that, that Foods for Living is going to take the bigger hit.
That was my next question.
Oh,
yeah.
I think one of the things, we have a very good relationship with Foods for Living. Even though we're in very close proximity, what they, I think, did, and they opened before I was in town, was, you know, they exploited part of that market that
right.
Elfco was not serving at the time. And we've kept that relationship where they serve a certain demographic and a certain group, and we kind of have our own group, and there's a little bit of overlap. We certainly know that. But we don't step on each other's toes. I think that Whole Foods is much more likely to step on their toes.
How have you rebounded from those days of 05, 06?
Well, you know.
Do you have more members?
We do. We do.
We
certainly see our membership base growing, you know, slowly and steadily. I think one of the things that we'll have to do is really go out and push to get new owners coming in the next couple of years. But we've also, I think one of the things we've done is provide a lot more value for shoppers and for owners. And the board and I continue to look for ways to do that.
How have you provided more value?
Well, you know, one of the things was when we were sort of on the financial ropes, one of the things I promised our shoppers was that if you shop the co-op and support us now, when we can, we will give you more value. So we did things like we gave owner-only discount days as soon as we could afford to do that, where, you know, it started out as 10% on the 10th day, and we would just be packed with people on the 10th.
Hmm.
And you know, sort of, you know, helping people figure out how to get more for the grocery dollar, doing better sales, you know, daily sales. One of the things we're working on is an everyday low price program so folks can have items in the co-op that they know are going to be low priced all the time. You know, and to broaden the range of people that we serve.
I find it interesting because the proposed location for the Whole Foods puts you three so close together. I don't think you could have planned this. The geography of the whole thing just really strikes me.
It is one of the things that Whole Foods does is they wait for somebody else to build the market and then they come in and exploit it. So. I'm not surprised, I'll say. I mean, you can see the location directly from our front door. It's
yeah.
right down the street.
Yeah, it's capitalism for you, I guess.
Oh, don't get me started.
What have been the challenges of doing business on Grand River? Has that been a good location for you guys generally?
You know, I think it worked. When we were facing troubles a couple years ago financially, one of the proposals was that we move, you know, with the idea that we were close to Foods for Living, that we were a little bit off the beaten track. We weren't right on Grand River. But that location has served us since 1980, and we actually went ahead and bought the property, and that really helped. So it's kind of an okay location. It's not great, but we make it work.
Another related bit that I'll share here involves the new Detroit Whole Foods, which opened to quite a bit of fanfare about 8 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, MLive reported that despite the complaints that the store would be too high-priced for Detroiters, Whole Foods co-CEO Walter Ropp told Bloomberg that, quote, the store is exceeding our wildest expectations. He added that the store is serving quite a wide area of the community. Little related thing I thought I would throw in there, not to concern you even any more than you already are, but we appreciate your coming in. Doug Finette is general manager of the East Lansing Food Co-op. We've been talking about the plans for Whole Foods in his area. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Current State, we'll look into the spike in baby boomer suicides. And we promise we'll have that interview with rapper Coolio. That's coming up as well. He's coming to Lansing. That and more Wednesday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks also to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Andy Curtis for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, supporting more than 1,100 businesses in the greater Lansing area for more than 110 years. Information at lansingchamber.org. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and with mobile banking. Insured by NCUA.